Campus FM presents The Probe. Produced and presented by Monique Chambers. Welcome to this week's edition of The Probe with me, Monique Chambers, and my guest this week is Dr. Engineer Mark Anthony Azzopardi from the Faculty of Engineering, specifically the Electronic Systems Department. He's working with satellites and high-performance vision systems. So tell us, what do you need high-performance vision systems for?
So, good morning, first of all. So high-performance vision systems have a number of applications, both in the industrial sector as well as in the broadcast market and the media market. So basically, whenever you see things like slow motion, that implies that some camera has been filming an event at a fast frame rate that then allows that video footage to be slowed down.
Okay.
So that's not only useful for the broadcast market and the media in general. It's also useful for research purposes because some events in engineering and scientific settings take a very short time to unfold, and it would be nearly impossible for the human to fully understand what's going on unless you have such a system to be able to record what's happening. Some of the higher performance systems can reach up to millions of frames per second, and a recent development was a technique for basically recording the motion of light itself.
Wow.
Using a very high-speed technique that reaches into the billions of equivalent frames per second. So we're not going there because that's a rather impractical way of doing things, but the way we're proceeding is towards more commercializable products. So basically, we'll be producing a saleable product.
And how fast does your vision system work?
It can range from a few thousands to up to 100,000 or so for the initial versions, and probably more eventually down the line.
And this is frames per second?
Frames per second, so exactly. It's number of pictures, number of photographs taken per second.
How big is one of these machines then to be able to take such a picture?
It's about the size of half a shoebox, perhaps.
Okay.
Yes, and it involves all the optics, the image sensors, all the very high-speed computing equipment, and memory, of course, because you need to store all that video footage somewhere. And it contains some very high performance electronics to be able to handle with all the data, the deluge of data produced by the image sensor in such a short time.
Is this something you could make work in my phone, please? Because I'm always running out of speed and storage.
Yes, yes.
So, that would be quite commercially applicable. But no, seriously, so this system, then what do you do with the shoebox? How would we use it in a practical sense somewhere like Malta?
So, for example, I've had requests, several of them in fact, from industrial players here in Malta who've requested such systems to be able to diagnose problems with production, for example, in a production line. For example, you might be using a very high-speed assembly machine, which might work well when things are slowed down, but then when it's working at normal speed, then things gum up, and you would like to see what's going on at high speed. And you need a high-speed camera for that. And other processes, such as, for example, laser-based welding or laser-based ablation. You would like to see what's going on that, or perhaps high-speed machining. Now, all these processes are very interesting to see carefully, one frame at a time, if you have the opportunity to do so.
So the human eye, I'm just wondering how fast this is in comparison to what the human eye can see.
Thousands of times faster.
Yeah?
Yes.
So yes. How do you disassemble, essentially, the imagery? How do you refine it so that you can see what's actually happening?
Well, There are a number of techniques. The simplest is simply a human going through all the footage, and that could take a while because there might be hundreds, if not thousands, of frames. But then, of course, there are a number of image processing techniques that could be applied in order to identify certain features you might be looking for in the footage. It gets quite mathematical in order to do that.
So how did you actually decide to start working on this project? It's Memento, I believe it's called?
Yes, Memento's latest incarnation, but it all started with my master's project back in 2006, where I was working on a method for high-speed vision of the human driver in a vehicle, so that you could detect the onset of sleep by looking at the blinking of the eyes and a driver. So some systems have already been installed on, for example, long distance driving trucks, for example, mm-hmm. for the trucking industry, where a trucker driving for hours and hours on end might doze off, and several accidents have been caused because of this. It's considered one of the highest risks, probably at par with drink driving. And we basically developed some equipment to be able to detect this. And then we proceeded further. We looked at techniques of how to synchronize a number of cameras. And then we actually issued a patent. It was the first patent of the University of Malta on an international basis for the World Intellectual Property Organization. And since then, it's been granted in a number of countries. And then we proceeded further. After I finished my doctorate, we proceeded further to apply for funds that basically leveraged some of the work that one of my students had done in the meantime on industrializing this technology. So we are now basically developing a fully fledged product.
So essentially, your patent is being used around the world by other inventors, universities, etc., etc.
It can be used, not being used at the moment, but we are trying to develop a product based on that that patent, and that's the idea now.
Excellent. That's really good news. So once the Memento is in action, what happens to the shoebox? Where else? So you can see it in factories and assembly lines, like you said.
No, factories and assembly lines, scientific equipment, such as, for example, high-speed sequencing machines use high-speed cameras, and they're limited in performance because of that, for example. It's another interesting application we came across along the way. Other applications in studying internal combustion engines, for example, to see what happens during the explosion in every cylinder of your vehicle, in the piston, above every piston, basically. And then, so besides research, then there's a whole other world which focuses on applications for the general media, so the broadcast market, such as, for example, you would like to take footage of a sportsman, for example, performing a particular sporting act, or other things that could be of general interest. These things sell quite.
Someone sort of kicking a ball, a particular.
Yes, and you can see the ball squashing and or hitting the wall and changing shape and bouncing off very slowly, and you can see everything.
And you can see it's something for an advertisement, actually, for a particular brand.
Yes, they're used quite a bit for that, in fact. Mm. A droplet of water hitting a surface of the water and then causing a splash, and you can see everything happening very, very slowly, or ink in dispersing in water. And there's so many other things that usually missed by the human eye.
So these cameras, so we can attach them to sea machinery and inside engines, etc., etc. Where else can it go?
Another thing we're looking at is basically combining this work with another piece of work we're doing at the moment, that is satellite technology. So if you combine high-speed vision with satellite technology, you can basically perform something called Earth observation. And with high-speed footage, you can combine a number of images to generate higher resolution imagery of the Earth from low Earth orbit.
But that's still quite far away. So
it's about 600 kilometers ahead, but spinning at about 15 times per day around the planet, and that's about 8 kilometers per second.
So that must have its own challenges.
Yes, of course. We started work on a small prototype satellite sometime last year, and it's basically intended to build capacity and to build know-how about the technology involved. Eventually, we would like to merge the two aspects, the vision and the satellites, into a future system.
So when I think of satellites, I think of, you know, the big tube with all the things reflecting off it. And is that the kind of satellite you mean, and this component will be as part of that?
That's quite interesting, in fact. Satellites have gone a long way since they were first developed. So the first satellite was actually a small device, but then as time went on and more sophistication got involved and included into the devices, they grew and grew and grew into multi-billion euro devices that were the size of a bus, and they cost the Earth to launch into space. Because, of course, you can imagine. but then, basically, a new development took place over the 90s and the 2000s, and that was no mobile phone technology. And mobile phone technology forced the electronics industry towards to heavily focus on miniaturization.
Okay.
Now, with that came the capability of including a lot of capability into a small space. And that means that what took the volume of a bus before can these days be compressed into the palm of your hand. And basically, technology moved in a direction which leverages what we can do here in Malta.
Excellent.
So,
so now the palm of your hand type of
yes.
size. And so this is a camera, essentially, that can see to Earth at this particular speed.
Yes, we're jumping a lot of steps here, but yes, basically. The satellites, the most common form factor is about a 10 by 10 by 10 centimeter cube. It's called a CubeSat. It's very popular. It's about over 100 of them have been launched by several universities around the world, and we decided to go one step further to try to catch up a bit, and we opted to go to an even smaller form factor, which also reduces our launching costs. So we opted for a pocket cube satellite. It's called so because it looks pretty much like the size of a pocket Rubik's cube. And basically, this quarter kilo device will contain nearly all the features of a typical satellite. The basic subsystems are all there. So attitude, controls, control orientation, batteries, solar cells, a scientific instrument, communications, a computer. There's everything in this tiny device. So it's a marvel of miniaturization. And it ties with the departmental vision we've taken over the last few years towards ever more advanced and miniaturized electronic systems, which is where everything is going these days.
So how does one actually launch a satellite if it's 5 by 5 by 5? I mean,
yes.
How does that happen?
It obviously doesn't take place alone. So basically, a number of small satellites are combined into a larger mother satellite, and which is then itself combined with other satellites, which are launched on top of a standard launcher that would typically be the size of, well, the length of a football field.
Wow.
And it costs tens, if not hundreds of millions for the launch. But the cost is divided, and obviously we just bear a portion in proportion to the weight and volume we occupy. So that makes it basically financially feasible.
And so what sort of cost is that?
It's about 25,000. So about the price of a car is what you need to launch a satellite in space these days.
Wow. Okay.
Before it was basically half the budget of the nation or so.
So is this, we're launching one, is that the plan, to do one satellite initially?
Initially, yes. The satellite basically drew many academics together to collaborate and also combine the efforts of a number of students to join forces and draw expertise from a number of areas which are already existing in the university, but they are dispersed a bit here and there, and we therefore try to collect them together with this common flagship project. And it's working well, and the team has formed quite nicely over the span of a year, and there is good progress. So far we're on track.
So when are you planning to actually launch this nano cube? I don't know what it would be called.
Pocket cube,
you said. When
are
you
launching? Yes. So basically it will be launched sometime in the fourth quarter of 2018.
Okay, so relatively soon.
Yes, in a couple of years, basically.
What are you expecting to happen once it's launched? Going to be looking
We tend to focus a lot on what happens before, but then obviously what happens after is equally important. This satellite will be hosting a payload. So the payload is basically an instrument, a scientific instrument designed by another university, by a Maltese student in another university, Jonathan Camilleri, who is reading for a PhD in Birmingham, and he is developing this instrument to measure the radio propagation characteristics of the higher atmosphere. And with a satellite up there, he can perform measurements in situ much more accurately than we can perform them at the moment from the ground, uh-huh. Basically.
So between the two of you, this is what it's going to be?
Yes, it's a collaboration of multiple entities. We also have the Malta Radio Amateur League, which are helping out with the radio systems. Because this will be basically launched as an amateur radio satellite, and that's the legal regime under which it mm-hmm. will be launched. So we also needed their help in this regard, and of course all different students, each one of them focusing on different aspects, from electrical power supplies to the attitude control and so on, and the other systems.
So when it measures, it beams back the information to you, or it stores the information and you get the satellite back?
Well, basically the satellite spins around the Earth about 15 times per day, and twice of those rotations it passes over Malta, over an 8-minute window it must download all the information it would have collected during the day. So yes, we'll be here with the antennas on the roof of the faculty, probably being carefully trying to receive the signals it will be transmitting. So basically we interrogate the satellite and it responds back by transferring the data down.
Excellent. So but when it's going to past all of the rest of the world, can they use its information as well, or it only talks to us?
We're not designing it in a way that it can be used by anybody. It's one of the principles of amateur satellites. But, I expect us and Birmingham to be using it mostly.
To do the same. So this, if you could just explain it in layman's terms, what it would be doing for radio stations, I guess.
Basically, one of the ways to communicate over long distance is to bounce off a layer. Okay, you bounce off radio waves off a layer at a very high higher layers of the atmosphere.
Okay.
So you send a beam, it's mm-hmm. reflected like a mirror, and it goes back down to some other place around planet Earth, beyond line of sight. You wouldn't be able to do that without this particular layer. But its behavior changes over time, and is very difficult to predict accurately. So okay. This particular satellite will give us a bit more real-time information about what's going on there.
Exceptional. It's just so big, actually, to wrap my head around what you're doing.
It's actually small.
if I could see it, I think it would freak me out even more to know that could actually do so much stuff. But even applying for a patent must have been quite a daunting task.
Quite.
Being the first.
Two box files, the height.
So what do you actually go through to apply for a patent?
Well, back then it was quite grueling because of the fact that the university had no structures in place. It was all based on my prior reading on the matter. So I registered with the first account with the European Patent Office. First, I had to go through all the law, and I drafted the patent myself initially, because obviously it would have cost the world if I had to go about it in any other way. But then, luckily, the university adopted some very favorable terms with respect to its staff and students, with respect to profit sharing of uh-huh. the royalties from patents, and, I handed over the patent to university. And They basically employed the first staff, and now we have a fully fledged
team
department here, if you can call it that, that handles intellectual property here.
So yours was the first, and when did you actually file for that patent? When was it?
So that was in 2008, back in 2008, and a lot of time passed already.
But now at least it's out there approved, like you said, licensed in particular
granted
countries.
Yes,
and
yes,
you're using obviously the
We're using our own, yes, of course. The idea is to try to build on that and create something that uses that technology.
And are you working on any other patents? Or you probably can't talk about them if they're not filed, can
well,
you?
Probably not. But yes, but we do work on a number of things, including our students. We encourage our students to look at the commercial viability of their projects. And we also issue titles in a way that lends themselves to producing products. We've got students who've actually managed to commercialize their final projects, and some of them were considering patenting as well. Some of them have actually been sold, and I bought some of their own products, which we're using for our own laboratories, in fact.
Must be very fulfilling, actually, to see that happening in your own.
Yes, it's been quite fast, in fact.
They're going to overtake you. So you're actually quite young as well.
We'll try hard to help our students overtake us. So that's the whole game.
But did you find the process itself daunting, or do you think that it's? I mean, how do you know you've got something that's worth patenting? How do you? I mean, today it must be slightly easier with more and more registers to be able to search. But how did you think, wow, I'm really sitting on something?
Yes, this is not an easy thing, in fact. First, you need to establish that whatever you're doing is actually novel. That's probably the easier part, however, although not by no means easy. But the harder part is actually making sure that what you're doing is going to yield enough benefit to offset the efforts that you would and the cost mm-hmm. of patenting itself, because it's not cheap at all. Obviously, lawyers are involved, you've got legal attorneys, and a number of them, translations, it's highly bureaucratic, and every step costs thousands. So
you really have to be sure of your...
And it's a long-term commitment, so if you're going to go for it, you must really know that you're in for it for the long haul. It's a 20-year long commitment.
And how long does it take to actually, from the day you realised I've got something, to actually filing...
Well, it's basically the time it takes you to write it up. that's all it is. But basically, the process is quite elaborate. But you first have a national stage. You first apply nationally. Then you've got 1 year time to think about whether you want to incur the costs of a future international stage, which becomes much more expensive. And then if you go for that, then it triggers a whole process. You decide in how many countries is going to be the coverage you're going to take in the number of countries, and then after that, after it's granted, you're given basically the right to exploit the technology and earn profit from that for 20 years, basically.
Right. Okay.
After that period, then it becomes common knowledge
and
free for all.
So you have to line up quite a few projects now to...
Yes, to maximize the benefit.
So you're going to be spinning off a company to
yes.
do this as well?
Yeah, that's the whole idea. The project we've undertaken with through funding with MCST, with one of my ex-students, and today one of my collaborators, is to develop the cameras into marketable products, into a refined product that can address a number of needs out there in the industry, and then we spin off a company to produce these.
Okay, what's the objective of those cameras then? How would they be used? What would people buy them to do?
They typically cost an awful lot, so you don't buy them to take pretty pictures only. But yes, they are used for, as I said, for as I mentioned, the various techniques used for slow motion. And
But is that something we could do anything for our, you know, our planning, our infrastructure? Is there that sort of thing? Because you have this.
Yes, but I'd like to draw a distinction here. Mm. The cameras is one thing, the satellite is another. Mm-hmm. If the combination of two is yet another. And that would be where I would like the our future to expand. And with that, we would be able, for example, to include one such high-speed and high-performance vision system in a larger satellite or a series of satellites in order to be able to perform imaging of the nation, basically, and that would be a national project. So that we would be able, for example, to monitor traffic, for example, or else monitor the shipping lanes, mm-hmm. or else, for example, be able to detect environmental disasters, oil slicks, fires, wildfires, for example, and react quickly to those. And other aspects such as, for example, it might help with planning, for example. Our building industry relies on high quality aerial footage mm-hmm. to be able to.
Exceptional. And then the pocket sats as a separate, you'd sort of sell the skeleton essentially? Is that the plan?
That is also a possibility. The satellites themselves, the smaller satellites, and well, all these small satellites can be and are being marketed separately. So even the different subsystems, the different portions of this of such systems, can be sold separately.
Excellent. So we should be looking out for your satellites in our 8-minute window at the tail end of 2018. I think it's really something. I think it's something you should broadcast.
Yes.
To, you know, people could go on their roofs and watch out for our satellite.
We will popularize it sometime further online. And yes, and obviously we intend to also make available the kind of equipment you would need in schools, for example, to be able to connect to it and see what's going on.
Fantastic. That's really great. I've been speaking to Dr. Engineer Mark Anthony Attapardi from the Electronic Systems Department here at the University of Malta. Thank you very much. Absolutely fascinating.
You have just listened to The Probe, produced and presented by Monique Chambers.